Hey there, is this Jay?
Yeah, speaking. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? It's Dylan here, set up with the Howard interview there.
Oh, thanks, Dylan. How you doing, man? Good?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing awesome, and it seems like you're doing well. So, yeah.
All good.
Oh, yeah, that's good to hear, man. Just wanted to talk with some of your early influences here. I mean, it seems like you're pretty partial to the Rolling Stones, Neil Young, and Bob Dylan. Were there any other sort of key artists that, you know, inspired you throughout your career or, like, in your formative years, I guess?
Oh, there's loads of them. I always liked songs. There's lots of folk stuff I liked growing up, and I got a lot of older brothers, and so I did tons of stuff from the 60s when I was growing up, because they were much older than me. So that was a big influence on me, you know, Brian Wilson, people like that. Phil Spector, you know, all that stuff was massive on me too. But singers are my greatest love, and that's why I always tend to be. I like all kinds of music, but it's melody and singers I tend to be pulled towards, and just the original voices I like, you know.
Yeah, some very distinct artists for sure. And the cool thing with those artists is you have that, you know, recall where you're very familiar with them. But as you, you know, go back to those certain records, I imagine you notice certain nuances and cool details that maybe you didn't notice upon earlier listens.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of the stuff that might have drawn you in first, but Neil Young's a good example, you know, that might have drawn you in would have been the more commercial stuff, which you have heard. And what it's actually, this is really early stuff when you get into it. It's amazing, you know. it's true. Is their growth as well is interesting, and what influenced them. And I mean, all of us are influenced by different people. I mean, he was influenced by a lot of people like Carole King and people like that as well. You can tell just with chord structures and things. But yeah, I mean, as I got older, I mean, I used to like Joni Mitchell, but I've liked him more as I get older, you know. When I was younger, I was like, oh, what's she singing about boyfriends all the time for, you know. And as I get older, you appreciate it. It's an amazing, you know, journey of her life. You look at it and that life experience, and she's in a world of her own to me, yeah. She's untouchable. But, you know, just great singers. I mean, there's no such thing as the best singer or the best artist, and anyone who's any good is just the best at being themselves, you know what I mean? So it's funny, but you know, Leonard Cohen. I mentioned a lot of Canadian artists, but I like a lot of Canadian. I noticed when I was growing up there, I was drawn to a lot of those. And I don't know why that was, but there's Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, and Neil Young were big. I liked Led Zeppelin a lot when I was younger. I don't like them as much as I'm older, because I hear where they stole from, like Otis Rush and all these people, where they just literally just lifted stuff, and that didn't impress me. What was good about Led Zeppelin was their power. But as soon as they lost their power, which they only had for a few years, that when Plant could really sing and stuff. And once you've heard Steve Marriott doing I Need Love and stuff, you know, you kind of go, that's not, I mean, it's just the journey is to be original and to be authentic, you know, and that's, and you can be influenced, but you have to find your own voice. And so they lost it for me a bit. But I enjoyed them growing up. But my favorites would have been people like Brian Wilson and that, you know, I mean, you know, Good Vibrations and just beautiful singing. I've always been into singing, you know, from a very, very young age. Like I was aware of singing, just be able to hit notes and go up and down scales, and I just love doing it, you know. I think a lot of us do. We find a great escape, and you know, my background, very working class, tough Catholic school I went to. But there was always music, you know. There was another world, safer place, and you know, just possibilities are out there with music. So, and I still find that with music too. And, you know, I'll always. I don't actually need to release records to be. I just write music all the time. And sometimes they get released, and sometimes I spend a lot of time not releasing them, but I'm always doing music, you know.
Yeah, for sure. So there was like a certain like rigidity to schooling in the early years there. So was there that sort of like local culture of, you know, key record stores or certain venues people would go to back in the day? Because I was just wondering.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, we're from, the nearest biggest cities were like, compared to where you're from, it's not far away. It would have been like 15, 20 miles away, but that was a long way for us. And there was a record store actually about 3 or 4 miles away I had to go to. But yeah, the trip to get to the good record stores, like Spiller's Records, which is the famous first record store in the world, I think it's known as, was in Cardiff. That would be an expedition. together there, but an adventure. You'd spend all day there, just rifling through records and sleeves, and you know, looking at the names and the notes and all that stuff. Which is obviously a great loss these days. We don't have that these days. Everyone does everything on Spotify, and it's very quick and disposable. Which is a shame, because there's so much information. You know, and I used to find even things like my oldest brother was quite conservative, big guy David, but much older. And he'd listen to things like The Seekers, you know, the Australian band. But the weird thing about those guys, they did a lot of folk stuff, you know. So they'd be doing stuff that Dylan would have been doing early on and stuff. So it was a good, it was very sweet sounding the way they'd interpret it. But it's still a great, you know, you do going down to Liverpool and all these kind of things. You do those guys too as well. So there's a lot of music out there, you know. It doesn't have to be all the, I said to a friend of mine, the way the media programs it, it's like the 60 records, and if you want, you've got to own those 60 records, and that's it. There's actually a lot more to it than that. Music was very, very important, and you know, you're always discovering stuff as well, which you weren't aware of as well. That's what I love about the world we live in today. There's a lot of information because the internet, you can find stuff. You're like, I wasn't aware of that. So yeah, there's big pluses.
Yeah, and I imagine you probably wanted to start making your own music pretty quickly, because it seems like you got enamored with the whole culture of just music and figuring out new artists and just really enjoying that. So when was it right away that you'd kind of decided, okay, I sort of want to make my own music and express myself?
Well, I was at that dream from a very young age, you know. When you're younger, you look for an easier route, you know?
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, there was people like, you would think, how can I make it the easy way? I mean, that's why a lot of bands make it, because we're all going, oh, I want to do it that way. I mean, people like Public Image and that would say things, oh, yeah, you don't learn to play guitar and, you know, be artistic and all the rest of it. And they were just talking bullshit, really, because you learn as you get older, the more strings you have to your bow, the more skills you have, the more you can interpret. I mean, I'm a better musician now than I was 20, 30 years ago. It doesn't mean I overplay and study do jazz progressions. It just means I'm more articulate and I've got more to choose from, you know? So, in fact, I still write very simply. I try to. The music industry, as we both know, it's not a great way to earn a living these days, but, on the other side of that is there's so much information on the web. I mean, you can look on YouTube, you can learn so much about guitars and things that interest me, for instance, and like, oh, wow, I wish I had that when I was 11. You pick up a guitar when I was young, and you need to know about actions or pressing the strings too hard or finger picking. I mean, it's like a mystery to you. And not many people helping you. Well, one of the lyrics in one of my songs says, you know, no one helps you, no one tells you anything, you know. That's because you'd ask people for advice, and they were just, most of them were like, not really helpful. So
yeah,
I want to be the opposite. When I meet people, I'm always saying, oh, this is how you do it. It's quite easy to do this. And, you know, I want to help people, make them happy, you know. It's much more fun.
Yeah, for sure. And I get what you mean. There's a certain distinction in the modern age where certain things can come easy in the sense of, oh, I can acquire all this cool information, but it sort of takes away that mystique of just figuring out on your own or just kind of crafting.
Yes, well, that journey. Well, I just find with guitar, for instance, I just think, you don't need to know many chords to write songs. That's something you learn early, and a lot of the best songwriters actually not very good guitar players. That's often the case, you know. And I learned early on that even though I wasn't a great guitar player, all the musicians around me needed me for the songs. And all songs are basically, you know, you can go to the root notes of the chord, and then obviously you can color that in and get someone else to play more sophisticated versions of that root notes. But ultimately, you know, a song's quite an easy thing to write. And I just think the more skills, I mean, the mechanics of getting your fingers used to moving is very important, you know, and things I didn't learn when I was younger. And now I learn. I mean, now I sang about 7 or 8 years ago. I said, I want to learn to play like that. And I decided, I'm going to learn to play like that. And people go, oh, that's really hard to do. things they used to say to me when I was 11 or 12, I still, even in my 50s, people say to me, you know, you're going to do that. And I'm like, no, it's nonsense. Anyway, all human beings do it, so I'll have a go at it. Maybe it won't be quite as good as, you know, as Patsy Cline's guitar player, but I'll you know, I'll have a go. And I just find it so rewarding. It's just, there's no rules, and you haven't got to play to anybody. Just make yourself happy, I always think, when it comes to music. So you can worry about who's judging you, you know, and that dial changes all the time of what's cool and what's uncool. So just be yourself, I think, and that's the key to everything, yeah, in life.
Yeah, for sure. If you're chasing like a trend or something that's kind of like topical or popular.
If you try to be what's hip at the time, yeah, and they say, oh, yeah, that's very hip. And then, I mean, if you look back at different phases of different music, a lot of people who are hip actually weren't very good, and people who are just vilified were actually really good. But the wheel turned, and people look back and go, oh, actually, that was brilliant. You know, so you know, it's, you know, just do your own thing, and you keep pure to your own dreams, and you'll be fine. That's my struggle, I guess. That's my aim as I write on my own. When I do my things, I work on my own with me and my acoustic guitar. I go on my little journeys. But with a band, it's a different thing altogether. You've got a very secure thing, and you got. I mean, my band, James, Pete, and Chris, and Gino, the Jezebel, I've known them for a very long time. They're just very great musicians, and I can work quickly with them. Whereas when I work on my own, it's much more of a cliff edge, you know. You're not sure how it's going to go, but I just love it. I love the performance and the free form nature of working on your own, which with a band, obviously, it's there's some sort of usually 1, 2, 3, 4, and off you go. It's very different on your own. So, but they both have great pieces. I love playing the band. The band is really brilliant, and you know, whenever we do gigs, it's fantastic. But I also like doing, you know, the self journey as well.
Yeah, and I think you got some cool guitars kicking around. You got a couple of Yamahas there, like a Yamaha FG180 50th anniversary there. So, like, what other kind of guitars do you have kicking around there? I imagine that keeps.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, yeah, I didn't used to care much about guitars, to be honest. I'd be like, oh, that'd be fine, whatever. To me, it was just a tool, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, so much more. You're not going to believe, but that FG180 I bought. I mean, that's the first guitar I've actually purposely bought as a guitar. I know I want that guitar. You know?
Oh, cool. Okay.
I mean, obviously, I'd like a nice Martin, you know, for a D35 or whatever from 1967 or 68. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm not going to, I don't have those thousands and thousands of pounds or dollars to buy that. And then I want something I can travel the world with, and I mean, I see the acoustic guitar, I see that as a thing of great, to me it means independence. It's why I don't have to rely on anybody. It's just me and that guitar, and I can be me, and I can give you what I have, my music, my songs, what's in my heart, very in a very pure way. But so that's I've got other guitars. I mean, I've got to tell you long stories, but I don't have many. I have another old Yamaha. I was looking for a cheap guitar originally, just for something I could do gigs with.
Yeah.
And long story, but I found the guitar on eBay, which literally cost me 12 quid. It's worth a few hundred quid, actually, but long story, someone advertised it, pickup only, as you got local pickup only, which puts off a lot of people. And, you know, one string, it's only got one string, and those kind of things. And it was a very bad picture.
Yeah.
And I know, and exactly, it's very funny. I thought the other con artists, they don't know anything about guitars. They just didn't know anything about guitars. It was just something in the attic. It's a 30-year-old. It's something they made from 1979 to 81. And I think it was one of those lawsuit guitars. I think Martin stopped them because he was copying one of their famous guitars. So I picked that up for nothing, you know. And then there was a laminate top. If you'd ask me what the difference between laminate wood and solid wood was about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years, I wouldn't have particularly known much difference about it. Now I know a lot. So, because I got interested in it, and you know, I developed my techniques, and I just indulged myself with them. So I love acoustic guitars. I could own dozens of them probably, but I'm always on the move. I don't really live anywhere. I just keep moving. So I want something, just one guitar really. That's ideal for me. Do you have any guitars?
Yeah, I've actually had some Yamahas over the years too, so that's why I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. They're very reliable. I always say to people who ask me, "Oh, if you just get a Yamaha, you're not going to fail. If you're learning to play guitar, just pick up $50 on a Yamaha, a second-hand Yamaha or something, you can't fail, you know? You really can't fail with them, you know? And obviously, if you want to spend a bit more money, they're amazing. This, my Yamaha I've got is a beautiful-sounding guitar, and I just love, I don't like fancy, showy guitars. I like things that are quite understated, you know? So,
yeah.
I just love it. What have you got, any expensive guitars?
You know, not really. I mean, like, even some of the electrics I've gotten over the years, like, I'll try to get them if they're on sale sort of thing. I have an Epiphone SG,
yeah.
which I managed to pick up for, I want to say, like, 150 or 100.
Wow. How does it sound? Is it good?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely dig it. The thing with certain like, because it's, like, in an SG sort of style, so, like, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
Certain SGs, the neck can be a little too much for me, but this one is, it just felt right, you know what I mean? Like, you know when you pick a guitar up, you're just like,
a great
okay,
feeling.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling, isn't it? My friend James, who's obviously plays James Stevenson, he deals in antique guitars and stuff, you know, so he's got amazing guitars. He's got a Gibson Hummingbird, but it's actually a Gibson Dove. From the 60s, but they just put Hummingbird on it because there was a long story that sold out of Hummingbirds. So they took a Dove and they just put Hummingbird scratch plate and the head thing on it, you know. And it is the most beautiful thing to play. You just pick it up and it's like, wow, you know. It's just, I mean, I wish I'd known that kind of stuff when I was starting out, because as you probably like me, we pick up guitars and they're really hard to play, they really hurt your fingers. And it took me such a long time to realize. I said to James, "Just not your fingers pushing the guitar." And he went, "No, it's really easy." And I was like, "What?" So so that was me learning how to set up guitars and all the rest of it. And I've learned now, don't press hard, and it's a revelation to me. So that's why I get excited by that, you know. So as far as you know, I see Epiphone. I'm releasing a $99 Les Paul. Have you seen that? Well, they have.
Oh, no, I haven't actually. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I told James about it. I saw him the other day, and he like couldn't believe it. Yeah, look on YouTube. Look for $99 Les Paul Epiphone. And apparently, all you can just change the machine heads, and it sounds great. They got cheap machine heads, and apart from that, yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah, for sure.
I can't believe you can make a guitar for $99, but there you go.
Yeah. No, the solo performances sound cool. It just sounds like a certain confluence, because you feel like you're, you know, going out there sort of by yourself, and there's that, like, scary, almost like living on the edge vibe to it. But also you were talking about how acoustic music sort of lets you just forget about everything and just be. So I find that to be a sort of cool confluence between two seemingly fairly different feelings there.
Yeah, they are. I'm going to do a gig in New York. I'm going to New York and, you know, see some friends. And I managed to get a gig there too in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, I always have a feeling, God, I'm useless. What am I doing this for? I just got to remember my experience. It's not like playing with a band. I know how the band's going to sound. On your own, with that guitar in your hand. So I'm very affected by the atmosphere of the room, and sometimes the song could totally overtake me. I mean, I did a gig. I haven't done that many gigs on my own. That's the whole thing, too. I did a thing with Trevor Tanner last year from the Bolshoi, Trevor, which is amazing. We just did six gigs together. But I learned so much in those six gigs. But I did a gig in Boston. I did a song called So Sad. And for some reason, I really connected with the song of when I wrote it. And I hadn't ever done that on stage before. And I started crying. I couldn't go on. I had to stop the gig. That was the end of the gig. And it was a real amazing thing for me about doing things. You actually, that connection to music, it's very theatrical, you know, and that's when it's at its best. And so now I tend to go on stage on my own and just try and feel it out and try to get to the song. And so every gig I do on my own is different, for sure. And I think I brought a lot of that to Gene Love's Jazz, because we just did some gigs in Europe, and we did a little bit of that where I'll just go on first, and I'll do a 6-minute solo song or something, and then we'll come on and we'll do Desire with some weird keyboards and things. We've been experimenting a lot more, which has totally reinvigorated us, you know. That's why the last album has been great for us, because prior to that we'd get together once or twice a year. We're all great friends, and we'd have a laugh, and everyone would get drunk apart from me because I don't drink, but that's another story. But I would be great, but we would come off stage, but it was easy, you know, there was no challenges to it. We just sing Desire and Break the Chain and popper songs, whatever we're playing, and they're easy to do. But when you start, you know, reapproaching and doing new songs, you've got a new album, or let's do some old songs, let's do them like this, though. It's totally reinvigorated us, and we've got put a real buzz to it again, you know, which is brilliant, because we did some gigs in Germany and the Netherlands, Portugal, and one in London. And some of you, I did a little acoustic thing in London the other day, and a guy came up to me from Cargo Records. I'm not hip at all, the big labels, but he said, if you ever want to do something, that was one of the best gigs I've ever seen, which is great, you know.
Because
we're not just going, that's amazing, because we're not going through the motions. That's my point. It's kind of that people, I think an audience can feel when something's buzzy. it was that was brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. You're not regurgitating the same record over and over again. But I love the passion for performance. It seems like those are just, you know, directly tied to the certain gigs you elect to play. Like I was seeing Combat Radio had shared out a photo a few years back. You were playing a few songs to benefit the homeless. It was a charity associated with that. And it seems to be, you know, it seems to be something that was very close to your heart there. So I thought that was cool.
Well, I move around a lot, you know, and I walk a lot. And you know, I hike a great deal and I walk. Like, once I finish this interview, I'll probably go for a walk for 15 miles, you know.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, and I see a lot of homeless people wherever I walk. Every city I've ever lived, you know, New York, Atlanta, I've lived in lots of cities, L.A. I walk them all. And I see a lot of homeless people. And so I get to know them. Like San Diego, I spot chat to them and ask them how they're doing. And they get to see you, you know, and so I have a lot of feeling for them because we're all, I stayed in Long Beach for a while, and that's a lot of homeless people in Long Beach in California. It was once a grand city or big town. At least the Americans call them cities, but they're big towns. And you have a feeling that it's obviously not what it was. I saw a thing on the local access that everybody in that town is pretty much one paycheck failure away from being homeless. And that's terrifying that people are living that close to the edge, you know, and at the times we live in. And you literally do see entire families that are homeless. And a lot of women, and you're thinking, fucking hell. It's not healthy, you know. It's not good. So I have a lot of time for the homeless. If I could do more for them, I would. And if I ever made a lot of money, I would put a lot into the homeless situation. We're all human beings, you know, and the older I get, the more I am more aware of that too, that we're all the same. We all want to be happy. We're all struggling, you know, and it's not good to let someone suffer.
No, I just thought it was cool that you were doing an effort like that because when I was in college, did a radio show surrounding homelessness in the Niagara region, and I just wanted to target kind of similar just because it resonated with me in a similar way, just wanting to help certain homeless people and get them aware. There, and I actually talked to a homeless guy, and he articulated it pretty well. He said, if there's one homeless person in any given city, then you have a homelessness problem. It's not this thing of, oh, there's 100 homeless people, there's 1,000 or whatever. And that's another factor, too. I mean,
perfectly put, yes, exactly right.
Very hard to get certain statistics on homeless people, too, with, like, certain couch surfers and things like that. So, yeah, I just thought that was cool. But I did want to talk about the latest record here because, I mean, you guys are – believing it was one of the best records you put out, and I was really blown away by it. Seems like there's a lot of positive feedback coming back. So how's that been?
Well, it's been good. I mean, as you can tell, I've been so entrenched in doing my own solo thing the last 12 months.
Yeah.
You probably know we get together like once or twice a year, usually in Portugal. We do a big festival or something, and odd gigs come up around the world, but. And every year, the guys always say, oh, let's do an album, because we play and we play well and we do a few encores. But it's usually the booze talking and they're off. As soon as we wake up the next day, everyone goes off to back to London or where everyone's living. I go back to L.A. because I spend a lot of time in L.A. And that's the last year of it. But the last time I just said, because I don't drink these days, I'm not interested in alcohol at all. So I'm just bored by it. And so I said to the guys, look, guys, you're all wasted now. And you say this to me every fucking year, you know.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy. I'd love to make a record. I've got tons of songs I write all the time, you know. Let's go and do one. But I'm also a bit lazy. I've got to confess to that, too. I'm not the kind of person that can just start a pledge music thing. But I said to Pete, let's do a pledge music thing. And Pete being Pete, just you know, he does get on with things, you know, and he got on with it and made it happen, and suddenly I was okay. Jay, you got to be in London or back in England for the winter, because I generally speaking find British winters a bit bleak, so I tend to go somewhere that's a bit sunnier if I can. Get away. But since we committed, I committed to make the record, and they need obviously need me to write songs and stuff. So I came back and spent the winter year in London, and we worked on the record, and it went really smoothly. And you know, it was a gas. You know, we didn't take any chances. I said before, you know, and we worked with Peter Walsh, because I know Peter's great. We all love Peter. Worked in a proper studio. Had the songs written. Didn't have any time for me to play. So I started playing guitar. So James Yorgan guitar. What about the vocals? And it was a brilliant, and it just worked really well. You know, lucky I didn't get the flu or anything, because it was in winter. I was a bit worried about that. And we'd literally worked before, you know, after all the messing around with for years not doing an album, within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, we'd made an album. And that a label, there was a label picked it up. It's a big label here, you know, indie label, but they distribute massively, you know, Plastic Head on Westworld Records here in the UK. And they loved it. I wanted to put it out. We were going to call it like Jay and the Jezebels or something like that, because we're all the problems with my brother out there in the US.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we haven't toured there for so long. But as soon as Pete and Chris started playing, because Pete and Chris have been playing the rhythm section tune of Jezebels since 1985. People don't realize that Chris Bell's on the Immigrant album is not credited as the main drummer. He's mentioned on it because he wasn't a member of the band at that time. He was in Spirit of Destiny. So, but yeah, so as soon as they plug in, you kind of went, James, oh, God, that's Gene of Jezebel. And the label were like, oh, come on, this is Gene of Jezebel. And we got all these problems, and they said, well, don't worry, we've got lawyers. We can handle any nonsense from your brother and or any of his nonsense, his agent, or whatever. I said, okay, if you can handle it, Gene of Jezebel. And so, yeah, and we played the song live. We did half the songs. We've only done like 6 or 7 gigs so far, but prior to the album coming out.
That must have been pretty cathartic, though. I imagine that'd be pretty cathartic and just refreshing. So you were talking about some of the issues with the two different iterations of Gene Loves Jezebel there. So it must have been cool to just, you know, get back to it, get in the studio. Like you were saying, it was a gas. You were having a laugh with all the guys, and you cut a record very quickly and some great material. So it must have been cathartic to have gone through, you know, the business kind of aspect of music that can be sort of negative, and just kind of get back to what brought you to the dance, so to say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, I'll never make another Gene of Jezebel record. And me and Pete, we were doing things like Ugly Bugs and that, just to get away from Gene of Jezebel because of all the negativity, seeing things on YouTube. Well, I didn't watch YouTube, but people telling me that people, I mean, things like Desire and those songs, they're my songs, and I sing them all. Suspicion, I'm singing those. My brother's miming to these things, you know.
Yeah.
And that pisses me off. And James gets pissed off that people are, you know, they don't understand this guitar sound, and you know, it's not like one of those bands like Journey and all those kind of people, and they get an exact singer that sings exactly like the original singer. Apparently, if my brother could sing like me, I'd be like, great, man, yeah, off you go. But if he would use his own name, and this is not James and Pete, instead we get, you know, I get a million emails, oh Jay, you're coming to South Dakota. I'm like, no. I'm, you know, all this stuff, you know. So, and it's frustrating. So, and it's spiteful and it's petty and it's all mental stuff that my brother does. And I just ignore, which drives him mad because I don't have any dialogue with him at all. So, yeah, to be able to go in and just plug in and the band just sounds like the band, you know. It's an amazing thing to me that wherever we play, people go, oh, my God, that's on the record. And that's what you want, you know. So that's, yeah, it was definitely cathartic. Yeah, it was good, very wonderful. The whole band is totally up about it. You know, Chris Bell just called me just now a minute ago, actually. But, yeah, we're all really happy with it.
Good old Mad Dog there. But, yeah, the Doghouse Studio, that sounds pretty cool. And you also did some work with Barry Barlow, Jethro Tull drummer there. So it must have been cool to have, you know, awesome people around you who have, you know, informed good perspectives on music that can help shape your sound as you want it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the great thing about that studio, because we did seven an album there, you know, which is basically all my solo songs for an album, and it was funded by a big fan called Taylor Robinson, who's now sadly passed away, I'm sorry to say, but he wanted to do an album with my brother involved, etc., and it was an awful record to make. I mean, but I'd met Barry on that down in Henley, where there was studios, Dogger's his, you know. And I liked all those people, but I literally, because my brother was there, I literally sang my vocals in a day or maybe a day and a half, and I literally went in, sang, spent another half day singing, and left. That was how bad the experience was. So it was strange to go back there after all this time, because we were in there in the summer before, and this was in the dark, in the depth of winter. And it was all so different. But Barry, yeah, I loved all of you. Barry's and what an amazing guy. I did a solo gig, and I mentioned you earlier, in New York. And I'd seen an old friend, I'm playing with in New York next month, my friend Dylan Handley. It's a coincidence for you. Okay. She's got a band called Lulu Lewis, and she's got people from, the guitar player from Tom Tom Club, and who she's married to, and some other people. And she got me a gig there. Well, they got me a headline. They're going to open for me, which is great. And she was, I've lost track. What I was saying? What was I saying to you? Oh, yes, Gary. I was doing a gig with those. And she came along, and I was chatting to her. She said, oh, Jay, what have you been up to? I haven't seen you for so long. And I said, oh, yeah, I've been working with, you know, at Barry Barlow's studio. And the sound engineer was probably a guy who was mid-30s. His mouth just dropped. Barry Barlow from Jethro Tull. He was just blown away, you know. And because Barry is like a legendary drummer for Jethro Tull, because I don't know much about Jethro Tull. I like those odd things of them. Things, as I said to Barry, what's good about Jethro Tull is they're unique. There's no one else sounds like them. And there's odd songs I've liked by them, like The Teacher and things. But I'm not an aficionado. But it was amazing to hear someone just be such a fan. And then Chris Mad Dog Bell told me, oh my God, yeah, Barry is like the, regarded as the drummer of Jethro Tull, and he's the influential one. But he's a lovely person. He's an amazing person. He's got a great sense of humor. He's very down to earth. He played some percussion. He played his gong on, what song did he do that on? I can't remember the song. What song is did he do that? But anyway, one of the songs, it'll come back to me in a second. And so, yeah, it was just great fun to do. It was at his studio. It's right on the Thames. And he's got all those rock star stories, you know, because he's from that era. He's on that. There's so many rock stars. Deep Purple and all these people, they all lived on around where he lives, you know. So he's got all those stories from that era, which is fascinating to me. So, but an awesome guy, and, you know, just brilliant. He was so good to us. He let us have extra time, and because we need a little bit of extra time, as you can imagine. He's very intense. And it was, that's why I described the experience as it was intense, you know. It was just no time to think. I mean, it was like, this has got to be done, and trying to stay focused. And it was a lot, back in the old days, we'd spend, you know, we can spend months on a record sometimes, you know. Go back in and out of studio, spend a few weeks here, a month there. This was all bang, 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 which is a beautiful way to do it, really.
No, I just thought it was interesting because it sort of made me think of my own experiences recording, because one of the producers in my local area when I was a young lad in Oshawa recording some, you know, tracks and certain things like that, there'd be a lot of Jethro Tull pictures in the studio. So it kind of
just made,
like my own personal sort of flashback there in my own way.
Yeah, they're a big band, aren't they, when you think about it? You know, those bands have such influence around the world. Oshawa, is that kind of rural?
It's in Ontario, actually. It's like pretty, like southern Ontario in Canada, sort of.
Oh, okay. That's where Neil Young's from, isn't he? He's from Ontario. Or is he from, no, he's not from Ontario. I used to go there, and I used to write, he's got a lyric, isn't he, about Ontario. There is
a
town in North Ontario, but you're from South Ontario.
He's definitely got some love for Ontario, but maybe the secret recipe for a good recording is having some Jethro Tull element in the mix there.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, I mean, there's a folky element, you know, all the rest of it.
Oh yeah,
some of this stuff. There's things he's done which are, I mean, he's a very theatrical guy back in the day. I think he's a bit selfish and all the rest of what I've heard from from Parry, but you know, but you have to give him this credit. Originality, as I mentioned, said to you at the beginning of this is, you know, so everything, you know, having your own voice is everything to me. That's what it's all about. That's the journey's about, whether it's music or whatever you do in life, just finding out who the hell you are.
Yeah, for sure. And the solo record you put out earlier in your career, Unpopular Songs, and we're kind of talking about Dance Underwater as well. I'm just kind of wondering if the songwriting process sort of differs between a solo recording or a full band recording, like in as far as, do you like lock yourself in a room, jam to records, get things going on that way? Do you like go on a walk? Do you keep like a notepad close so when inspiration organically strikes, you can write it down? How does the songwriting process usually work, and does it differ between a solo offering versus Dance Underwater?
Well, for me, there's different options for me. I've always had notebooks and I've written things down, but I never end up using any of that stuff. I tend to have a guitar in my hand or a microphone in front of me, and something just comes from somewhere. The songs like Desire, I'd just be going around the riff round and round and round, and then it would come to me. And that's what I think about a loop pad, which I use, one of the Ditto Looper, whatever you call it, where you can just play something and then it'll just keep on repeating itself. Trevor Tanner got me to those a bit, you know, and I would just play one of my little riffs or whatever I've got, and I'll just let it go round and round and round, and then stuff comes, you know, just it's coming from nowhere. So I write like that sometimes. But generally speaking, if you see on my Facebook, I'll just post things that come to me. Literally, if I have a feeling, it just comes to me and bang. I always find with the band, if I'm in a room with them and James has a riff or Pete has something, I'll go, oh, I really like that, and that'll inspire me to write something, you know, on the spot, as it were. So it just varies. I mean, things like, because Pete Rizzo was involved a lot in the songwriting this album, because of our stuff, we grew a lot together doing Ugly Bug stuff. You know, I just taught him how to sing, and he plays all the guitars, and like most of the guitars on Ugly Bugs. And he plays some guitar on this album, and he's brought some ideas, and he had one song, Cry For You One Day, for instance. That's actually a song about Brexit. We're both very upset about Brexit. And it was supposed to be spelled Cry For EU One Day. But you wouldn't spot that from the lyric. But he played me the song, and I go, oh, yeah, I got something for that, Pete. And so, and it was actually, I wrote a massive amount, almost Dylan-esque song about it originally. But then I just simplified it, you know, as much as I could. So, they come from different areas, really. I do like it when people, you know, people send me some, like Jean-Marc Lieberman's guy. He was a very early version of Gina the Jezebel. He sends me stuff, and Julianne Regan, and they'll send me, like, oh, I like that, and I'll sing to it if I like it and see what comes. But yeah, I like working with other people a lot. It's great fun for me. It takes the pressure off me, yeah. Sometimes it's like when I did the song Is It Me, it was like the band, like, oh, have you got another song, Jay? So I'll be going through all my songs. But I love it when they come up with something. But this album, was a lot of stuff, just me and Pete, really.
Yeah, it's cool. Exactly. Like you're talking about, there's such like a multiplicity to how you can put together certain songs. It seems like you go also for that folky kind of organic approach where, you know, you get the authentic sort of like unbridled feeling out there, you know, like Neil Young-esque, write a song.
The purity,
also, like the looper pedal and stuff like that, and like certain, you know, like you use the pedal board, you can have like more sustain and certain like, more affectations to it. You can add certain layers to it that
definitely.
Way.
So, yeah. And they can bring out different things. There's no perfect, there's no right way, there's no wrong way. A lot of things can happen, as you know. But I love just having a guitar in my hand and just singing. I just find people get inspired around me. So it's a glass of water. People get inspired when you just strum them a tune. Not that I'm a very good judge of my own tunes. I think I mentioned before, you know, usually I get James or you'll spot what a good tune. You go, oh, you must do that one, or you must do that one. And even when Pete and I did stuff like How Do You Say Goodbye to Someone You Love, we didn't realize it was such a good song. James saw us do it live and was like, oh, you got to do that song with strings. And that's where you could pull Tony Visconti in to do the strings on that, which is cool. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool to get those outside voices too. And speaking of different outside voices, it seems like there's a lot of engagement with different fans, you know, people sharing pics of them with certain band merchandise and whatnot. And we were kind of touching on certain aspects of being a musician in the modern era, but how cool is that aspect, you know, in as far as that direct interaction with your fan base?
I like it. Personally, I never liked it before when we used to make albums and there was no access. People always had impression of me that I'm not accessible, when actually I'm a very accessible person, you know. And I was aloof and all this stuff. And this is something that the old system seemed to create, this distance between other people and the band, or fans, for want of a better word. I like the interaction. I mean, I've enjoyed, as you know, I have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and all that stuff. I enjoy all that, and I like the feedback. I mean, I wouldn't know. When I put song ideas up, even to this day, I'm thinking, oh, is this any good or not? And I'll just put it up to see what people think, and I get feedback. Some people say, oh, that's a weird one, Jay, or whatever. But I love that feedback. It helps a lot. So when we had people feeding back to things we were working on, we had fans visit the studio one day and stuff, it was great for them to hear it, and, you know, because they're the ones who literally put their money where their mouth was. You know? We made the album thanks to them, you know. There wouldn't be a Dreamers Jazz album unless the pledge music, if the fans hadn't, you know, put the cash down for it. And yeah. So we've made another Dreamers Jazz. There's a big gap between albums, but we've made an album that should sit nicely with, you know, House of Dolls, Discover, and Immigrant, and all those records, because there's a link to them all through this lineup. So that's amazing to us.
Yeah, and like distinct records with, you know, each new offering too, as much as they're part of your, you know, discography and all of that. I mean, each record sort of has that distinct identity. But it's kind of cool because, yeah, I get what you're sort of saying. It seems like the old way that the music industry would sort of work, or like how they would frame it before, is almost like the artists were put on some sort of pedestal and they were kind of inherently distant from the fan base, and that's how people would look at them. But now there's like more of like a, almost like a communal.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, I
like that personally. Like, oh. I think music is naturally theatrical anyway, you know. And this idea, I mean, David Bowie, for instance, being an extreme example of someone that was totally image, and which was to the detriment of his music a lot of the time, I thought. People never talk about what a great singer he was, because they're just all about, oh, do you remember that look he had? Or, oh, he did this thing with aliens, yeah, or whatever, you know, you're kind of going, he's actually a really good singer, you know, with a great sense of melody, you know. But they never talk about that because it's all lost in image, you know. And when I was a kid and I liked music, I didn't know what Led Zeppelin looked like, you know, the first album I heard was Led Zeppelin 2, and there wasn't much picture on that. And I just liked the music, you know. It was a big shock to me that, you know, I showed my friend a picture of Jimmy Page and they thought, oh, is that Mark Bolan? It was like we were totally unaware of their, you know, the cock rock and, you know, the very glamorous image they actually ended up having. But I just like the records. I mean, I went to see them, you know, and I was hugely disappointed that they weren't as good as the record by any means, you know. So they were good. So I look back on it, but not compared. I mean, you didn't. They came on and sang Rock and Roll, and these things are like two octaves down or whatever from the original. It was a bit disappointing. I don't know what to do with just abuse, you know, looking after, you should look after yourself. Look after your instrument, your gift. Look after your legs. You want to walk, look after them. So, you know, it's image. I mean, people say to me, oh, Jay, glam rocky, wore makeup and all the rest of it. And I'm like, well, that's just me. I do that anyway. It's nothing to do with music. You know, it's just me. I'm not trying to appeal to someone, you know, to like my music. It's just the way I like to look. You know,
it's not like same with the band. Yeah, I get what you mean. It's not like this carefully crafted aesthetic where you're trying to like evoke a certain reaction from people. It's just you being yourself there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could otherwise, you just play the game. It's probably one of our flaws. We don't actually fit in with anyone because we don't really. We didn't play that game. We could have just worn Rolling Stones t-shirts or I don't know. Whatever was cool at the time, you know, Radiohead, I don't know, and then just pretended to be like, you know, New Order, Joy Division, Never Smiling Pictures, just image, you know. It's just a lie, you know, and it's just an image that people like to buy into image, you know, and I understand it's a product to them. I always thought when people said what's like an alternate indie labels, that's all very cool, but they were just as, you know, no difference to major labels really. They're just trying to make a buck as quick as they could.
Yeah.
So to me, it's always about the music. And people say, "Oh, yeah, what'd you get into music? What'd you get into music for?" Yeah, sex, drugs. Yeah. No. When I saw David Gilmour on an interview, who's amazing, in my opinion, by the way. I was amazed when he said, "No, I got into music for music," and I was like, "Oh, my, thank fuck for that," because that's exactly what I wanted to get into. I wanted songs, you know, and find out who I was. And that was just so refreshing to hear someone else say that. And I think it's probably lots of us, you know, we're into music, you know. So yeah, I can't say everybody in my band was like that, but the four of us were at least.
Yeah, and that's what you got to find. I mean, at the end of the day, it is all about the music there. But you've been really good with your time, man. Is there anything you wanted to add as we're wrapping up here?
Oh, no, thanks, Dylan. Thanks for very in-depth. Thanks, man. No, it's all good. Just, you know, hopefully we can come out to Canada again soon. You know, we're going to be in Japan in November and hopefully doing some UK gigs. And the album comes out in the US this month sometime. And I'm sure it must be coming out there soon, too. So hopefully we can come out and visit.
Yeah, that would be cool for sure. If you're around Alberta for whatever reason playing, you'll have to reach out. Definitely one to come out to.
Oh yeah, I love to go. Alberta is one of my favorite Neil Young covers. Actually, yeah, I think I'll go out to Alberta.
So,
that's a great cover. Actually, when I heard that song, Pete, I did that. I sing that song sometimes, never live, but I sang it to Pete Rizzo, and he prefers it to Neil Young. So I said, "Oh, thanks, Pete." But when you hear that song, you realize Neil Young's that is such an influence on Neil Young. That particular song, you can hear a lot of his music by. Would take that form, you know, and I loved it when I saw that thing on him, and he just said when he heard that song when he was like 16 or whatever, he just couldn't stop playing it, and he's amazing. But there's lots of amazing people out there, Dylan's, loads of them, billions and billions of people that are great. Yeah, you know? That's why we like music, right? There's tons of stuff to be discovered too, you know. So
absolutely, yeah, it's a beautiful thing for sure.
Yeah. All right, Dylan. Thanks, man. Appreciate you calling. Thanks for the interview. And I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, for sure. Sounds good. And yeah, once I post the article and everything, I'll obviously link Howard to the interview, and I'll link it to you on social media and certain things like that. But yeah, again, thanks for your time. A lot of great insights there, and hope you enjoy the rest of your day, man.
You too. Thanks, Dylan. Have a good one.